Good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing, Grace?
Good. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. As people are coming in, I'm just going to say something because we are recording today for the podcast so that people can listen to this later. And I was only asked to record it today. And that means that anyone who is following up, hi, Jeanette, on the podcast, means that they have missed chapters 1 through 4. And that is unfortunate, but there we are. Chapters 1 through 4 were not recorded for the podcast. So, good morning, my friends. How are you today?
Good. Looking forward to this meeting.
Excellent. Well, it is a little after 10, so even though other people may come in as we continue on, I'm going to get started because we got some juicy material here today, friends. I mean, you may have thought the first 4 chapters of Revelation were crazy, but once you get to chapter 6, the craziness descends in force. So let me talk to you this morning just a little bit about some of the imagery that you're going to see. And, you know, if you've read Revelation before, it's going to be familiar. So we've got mentions of the lion and the lamb. Now, remember that images of the lion, while it might evoke C.S. Lewis's Aslan, Aslan came after and was influenced by the revelation to John. So this image of Jesus as the lion of Judah, the lion, that is an image from the Hebrew scriptures. And it was first given in Genesis to Judah, one of the sons of Israel. You know, he was one of the 12 tribes of Israel. That's where the imagery began, or at least in the Holy Scriptures. That is the first moment that we get this lion imagery. But then the image of God as lion is throughout the Old Testament. It's in lots of different places and it's in the Psalms. But all throughout that, even in the prophetic literature of, say, Isaiah, which is where a lot of references to Jesus like to draw, like, oh, look, Jesus was foretold and foreshadowed. They usually look at the suffering servant passages from the prophet Isaiah. There's no lion imagery there. So the God as lion was God, like God the Father as lion. And it wasn't like a messianic image. It wasn't an image of the Messiah who comes to rescue. It wasn't a King David image. And so it's really in the revelation to John, that's really the first place where we get to see the lion image kind of shift and change and become an image associated with Jesus.
Repeat again, and what was it originally, the image back in Genesis?
The lion of Judah. Judah was compared to being a lion cub.
Mm-hmm. What kind of characteristics did it portray that God?
Strength.
Okay.
A profound amount of strength. It was recognized as an apex predator even then.
Okay.
So strength and domination.
Okay.
And it was, you know, part of it was his relationship with his brothers, that he would dominate his brothers. And so he did. But then the lion image is contrasted with the lamb image. Now, the lamb image comes to us most strongly, and the sacrificial lamb image comes to us most strongly from Exodus, where we see the Israelites oppressed in Egypt and the way they finally get away after Moses and the craziness and the plagues was the Passover supper, the very first Passover supper, where they sacrifice the lamb. And just to be clear, it can be a goat or a sheep. It doesn't matter. If it's a baby, it's a lamb. They sacrifice the lamb and put the blood on the lintels of the doors and so escape the angel of death. So the sacrificial lamb is a huge part of the salvation imagery of the Jewish people. And in other places, like the Gospel of John, for instance, we hear Jesus talked about as the sacrificial lamb. Now, it's more than just Exodus, of course, because they had a religion whose purity and kind of renewal was based in large part, not entirely, but in large part, on sacrifice. And some of that was animal sacrifice. Not all of it. There were also grain sacrifices and oil sacrifices and sacrifices of incense. And then people would get into metaphorical sacrifices, like, can I sacrifice my anger and things like that? Okay. But there were also animal sacrifices. And if you were wealthy enough and your sins were great enough, a lamb, unblemished, was one of the things you might have to sacrifice. If you were really poor, it might just be a couple of doves. But we've got this imagery between a sacrificial lamb who is innocence and weakness, and the dominating lion who is power and dominion. And we have these two married in chapter five. I had to double check my numbers. And so that's some of what is behind the lion and the lamb imagery. There's also going to be the imagery of an eagle. Lots of crazy animals here going on. The eagle imagery, even though we are Americans, and the people who are listening to this podcast might also probably be Americans, and the bald eagle is a very familiar image to us, and we know what it means. Please remember that they were not presaging the U.S. They were not prophesying about the U.S. The U.S. got the image of the eagle as a national emblem from ancient Rome. When the revelation to John was happening, it was an ancient Rome. It was their current oppressor. And so the eagle, they're talking about Rome. And the eagle has three heads and 12 wings. And, you know, we'll get into that. But they're talking about Rome and all of its different rulers and emperors and the bids for power that were going on, because succession was not an easy thing and maintaining power was not an easy thing. If you've read anything at all about that period of time in ancient Roman history, it's a wild and crazy time. So that's what the eagle imagery is pointing to. And we also have this image of victory without war. So the lamb who was slain has victory, but he was slain, he was sacrificed, he's having victory without war. And this is not something that John was just glossing over, because John's totally fine with violent imagery. But we need to remember just a little piece of the Jewish history of the time. And that's what makes me want to just mention briefly the Maccabean Revolt. So this was happening about 167 BC. And the reason the Maccabean Revolt happened, there were always tensions between the people who were dominating over Israel and the Northern Kingdom and the people who were being dominated in Israel and the Northern Kingdom. And so what happened was the Seleucid emperor at the time, and if you remember, Alexander the Great conquered lots and lots and lots, but it didn't last after his death. And then all that he conquered was split up into, I think, three bits. And the Ptolemies got Egypt, and there was the Seleucid Empire, and that covered Israel, among lots of other places. So the Seleucid Emperor and this is before Rome came in. His name, it's a great name, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. That's a fine grand name. So what Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did was he brought in a statue of a foreign god and put it in the middle of the temple at Jerusalem, which they then called the desolating sacrilege. And then on the altar to God in the Holy of Holies, he sacrificed pigs. Remember, kosher laws do not allow bacon. And to even farm pigs was a disgrace and makes you unclean. And you certainly don't want to eat pigs. And you sure as shootin' don't sacrifice them to the one true God. And you don't sacrifice them on the sacrificial table dedicated to the one true God, even if you're sacrificing it to somebody else. I want to say the desolating sacrilege was Zeus, but I can't remember. I apologize about that. And so he also was forcing Jews to eat pork. That was part of the way that he tortured them. But he also tortured them in truly gruesome and horrific ways. And there's accounts of it in your Apocrypha. If you look at 1, 2, 3, and 4 Maccabees, that's what's going on there. And if you want the really gruesome details, look at 2 Maccabees. And so what happened was there was a revolt because of the desolating sacrilege. And the revolt did not end well.
When did it start, the revolt? You mentioned it.
You know, I think the desolating sacrilege was about 167. So it started thereabouts.
167 BC. Okay.
Yes, 167 BC. And so it was terrible and ugly. And there were lots and lots and lots of martyrs. And that didn't totally crush the spirit of the Jewish people, but it did a really good job of crushing the spirit of the Jewish people. And so this idea of being able to win over an oppressor through war, not everybody was sold on it because it hadn't worked in the recent past. And so this image of, you know, God's strength is beyond human powers, and somehow God will deliver us from this. That's one of the reasons why there's a lot of warlike, emperor-like imagery, and also there's some missing. So there's a tension there. It's not all one or all the other. There's a tension there because it was a warlike culture. And war was understood as the horrible thing that sometimes has to happen. And sometimes it wasn't really recognized as the horrible thing that sometimes has to happen. Sometimes it was recognized as the perfectly righteous thing that God is demanding, which is a little bit different than many of us view war today. So, and then in chapter 6, we get into some really vivid and some ambiguous imagery. I mean, we see the four horsemen of the apocalypse in chapter 6, and we see more than just them because they're just one small part of the whole. And so let us dig into it. Would anyone like to read chapter 5 for us? Donna, we can't hear you. It might not be Donna, because we still can't hear Donna.
But you can hear me.
I can hear you, Jeanette, and I know I can hear Grace because we spoke briefly. Yep.
Donna.
So Donna, what you want to do, you're not muted in Zoom, but that doesn't mean that you're not muted because of some setting in your computer. Okay, well, we still can't hear Donna, and I apologize for that. Donna, if you can't figure out your sound settings, you got to type your questions into the chat, my friend. While Donna figures that out, we're going to continue on. Jeanette, don't worry about it. Sometimes these technical things happen.
Okay.
Since Donna was the only one willing to read, I will read chapter 5.
I'll read it.
Okay, great.
If you want, Jeanette. Okay, we're on what? Chapter 6, we said, right?
Chapter 5.
Oh, chapter 5. Hold on. I wasn't here last week, so I wasn't exactly
That's
sure.
That's okay.
Where we're at, chapter 5, the Starfelt, the scroll and the lamb. Okay, so starting with chapter 5. Then I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne, a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals. Then I saw between the throne and the 4 living creatures and among the elders, a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one who was seated on the throne. When he had taken the scroll, the 4 living creatures and the 24 elders fell before the lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. They sing a new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slaughtered, and by your blood you ransomed for God saints from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests serving our God, and they will reign on earth. Then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels surrounding the throne and the living creatures and the elders. They numbered myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, singing with full voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slaughtered to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them singing, to the one seated on the throne and to the Lamb be blessings and honor and glory and might forever and ever. And the 4 living creatures said, Amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped.
Thank you, Jeanette. Let's take a moment to let that sink in silence. And then we'll start our conversation. Right. You can either speak or type in the chat. What jumped out at you?
Well, initially, what jumped out at me a little bit, it was in the first, verse 5, it says, see, the lion of the tribe of Judah can open the scroll. And then almost in the next verse, it says, the lamb does it.
Yes. Yes. So
when did the lion turn into the lamb, right?
Well, it doesn't say that the lion turned into the lamb. It's announcing, look, there is the Lion of Judah. He is worthy. And in walks the sacrificed lamb. And so it's not the lion turns into the lamb. No. It's that the lion is the lamb. don't imagine that this is stuff that is physically possible to see. This is like recounting a dream to someone. All right. Nothing in the chat yet. I'm going to keep my eye on it, Donna, in case you are, in fact, typing questions over there. Anything jump out at you, Grace?
No, and here, I mean, I know they're talking about God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me just throw this out. You may have noticed that the lamb has seven horns and seven eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me talk about what that means. So horns were images of power. And eyes were images of knowing or seeing. And seven as a count of something. And this is true for the seven churches in Asia. And we just heard mentioned the seven seals on the scroll. Seven is the number of completeness. If you want a complete thing, you want seven. Now, where does that come from? It comes from one of the two accounts of creation, the one that happened in 6 days, and then on the seventh, God rested. That's where we get that image of completeness from. And then it's picked up and carried on throughout the Holy Scriptures. And so if, you know, we look at this lamb that has seven horns and seven eyes, and now, and it's been slaughtered. So it's a dead zombie lamb with seven horns and seven eyes. I know, it's ridiculous, Donna. It's totally ridiculous. So the seven horns means that this is the picture of someone who is omnipotent. They don't just have power, they have all power. They have complete power. It's weird, but it wasn't directed at us. It was directed at them, so it made sense to them. The seven eyes would mean that this lamb, not a mutant, is all seeing, all knowing. There's a completeness to how this lamb can see. You, me, the world, the past, the future, everything. This lamb is omniscient. And so that's the way in ancient Hebrew metaphorical, allegorical language to represent a figure that is omnipotent and omniscient. Because you can't just hang a sign from them and say, I know everything. It wasn't done. But seven horns and seven eyes, that's a pretty good sign.
I can ask a question when you're done. Go ahead.
Yes, go for it.
Why a scroll? I mean, it's introducing these seven seals, and these seven seals turn into different things, I assume, in the next chapter. But why a scroll?
Okay, so remember that a scroll was how they could transmit information. There were no books, there were no texts, there were no emails. You did occasionally in the very ancient world get codexes or codices. So a codex would look book-like, but it would actually be more like this. So this actually is the folder for my traveling Bluetooth typewriter. So, you know, it goes in like this, and it's nice and protected, and it's like a little envelope, and you open it up, and there it is. But this is more like an ancient codex than an actual book, because it would have a kind of a hinge mechanism here, a binding, if you will, but it would just have like the cover, and then inside the cover, there might be like a wax tablet here and a wax tablet here. And so it was for either practicing handwriting or very ephemeral things. Like, I'm just going to make a quick list to remind myself in the day, and then I'm going to wipe it clean. It's how, you know, in the Wild West, they had slates and chalk, and that's how the children learned, because paper was expensive and pencils were expensive and pens were prohibitively expensive. And so in the ancient world, if you wanted to write a document that would last and last and last in this area of the world, because it does change a little bit area to area, you would put it on a gigantic scroll. And they're thick. And to get to the right place in the scroll takes time and effort. And if you've ever, ever been to a Jewish worship on a high holiday, you might actually see someone reading from a scroll, and it's gigantic. And so important documents, documents that needed to last, oh, Qumran, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found through the twin joys of archaeology and goat farming, they were sealed in jars to keep them intact. It worked mostly. But they were scrolls. They weren't scraps of paper and they weren't books. Now, they disintegrated, so they became scraps of paper, but they started out life as scrolls. So why a scroll? That would have been the natural image for something as important as God's plan for the world. That would have been normal and reasonable to expect them to have. And if a scroll is sealed, that means only a certain person is meant to open it. And perhaps you're meant to open it at a certain time. Otherwise, it would just be tied. But if it were tied and then there was a wax seal on top of the knot, you could tell if it had been tampered with. Because you can't just slide it off the wall. Because scroll has, you know, there's essentially wooden dowels at the basis of the structure of the scroll, but then they're kind of flat plates at the top and bottom of each wooden dowel that helps to keep the scroll neat and tidy. And you can't slip a piece of string or yarn or whatever it was, not yarn, that was silly. Sorry, I'm a knitter. Sometimes I just think of yarn. You can't slip a sealed string off the end of a scroll. You could see that it would be tampered with. Pardon me. So that's why a scroll. Any other thoughts? Things that stick out at you? Grace, I know you've read this before. Anything that sticks out at you this time around?
I'm good. You're doing a very good job.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Okay. Let us continue on to chapter 6. I'll read it. Then I saw the Lamb open one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures call out as with a voice of thunder, "Come!" I looked, and there was a white horse. Its rider had a bow. A crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature call out, "Come!" And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people would slaughter one another. And he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature call out, "Come!" I looked, and there was a black horse. Its rider held a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's pay, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's pay, but do not damage the olive oil and the wine." When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature call out, "Come!" I looked, and there was a pale green horse. Its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. They were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with a sword, famine, and pestilence, and by the wild animals of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slaughtered for the word of God and for the testimony they had given. They cried out with a loud voice, "Sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long will it be before you judge and avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth?" They were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number would be complete, both of their fellow servants and of their brothers and sisters who were soon to be killed as they themselves had been killed. When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and there came a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth. The full moon became like blood. And the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree drops its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll rolling itself up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and their magnates and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone slave and free hid in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of the one seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" Let's sit in quiet with that horrifically violent imagery and let it sink in for a bit before we discuss. What jumps out at you?
Well, I was wondering about the color of the horses. Do the colors signify something in particular? Like the white, the black, the red, and the green?
Right, they do. So the white horse, its rider comes with a crown and a bow. And that is meant to be a king, conquest. The idea of someone who dominates over you and has the decision of life or death over you. The red horse, red is the color of blood, and war gets a red horse. So war gets a sword and a red horse. Then we have the third rider who gets scales and a black horse. And this one has been interpreted as famine. But listen, because the black horse, the third rider, is the only one who gets to speak. The third rider gets a speaking role. And look at what the third rider says. "A quart of wheat for a day's pay and 3 quarts of barley for a day's pay, but do not damage the olive oil and the wine." So what that is meant to represent is a merchant with ruinous rates. In a time of famine, there's no such thing as giving away anything. And the wealthy will be able to survive and the poor will all starve. And so you can call that rider famine, and the blackness would be probably the blackness of a dead body that's been left to rot. That would be my guess on that one. But it's not just famine. It's famine due to this kind of corruption and preference for the wealthy. It's a very specific kind of famine. Not everybody's dying of hunger. And then the pale green horse, and in our culture, he's often not pictured on a pale green horse, just pale horse. So he's sort of a whitish horse, because pale green is odd to us. The pale green horse, you know, that's another vision of how a body can look at death or beyond death, which we don't often see, because funeral homes like to hide all the messy bits of death from people who mourn utterly and completely. Utterly and completely. It has been something I have noticed during my ordained life since I was ordained. What's up, Jeanette? What do you see?
So we've got these four horses, but whose conquering ability and famine, you know, who does this apply to and when?
That's a good question.
You've got conquering ability, you've got you know, you've got war because of this red horse, and you know, mm-hmm. you've got famine and death, but who's experiencing all this? Who does it apply to?
Well, it's meant to apply, I believe that it is meant to apply, as John is writing it, to the very near future, the next year, the next 2 years, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, that he perceives that there will be this kind of conquering massacre, that people will die from famine, from pestilence, from war, from conquering and marauding empires. And think of the time, you know, only 2.5 centuries before, it wasn't the Romans who had conquered them. It was Alexander's successor. And the time that would come later, it's just one wave after another. And that is born out in Israel's history. They have had to field one wave of conquerors after another. And it wasn't just one conqueror. They were in the middle of kind of a triangle of land that was sought out by many. And so sometimes the northern kingdom would be conquered by one people, and the southern kingdom would be conquered by a different people. And so it wasn't just an army that might come through and maraud. It was army after army after army after army. Century after century after century, it never stopped. And so to say, okay, this is specifically foretelling this, or this is specifically talking about that, in this portion of John, we can kind of back up and take a more general view of the situation and think, these people have been a conquered people for at least 700 years. And if you count the Exodus, it goes back farther than that. This was just their reality. This was how the world unfortunately worked for them. And unfortunately, when we look at the history of the world since then, peace and prosperity has not been the reality of most of the earth. Freedom from famine only came since about the 50s, when people all across the world could reliably think that they probably could eat tomorrow. That was recent. Freedom from war has not come. Freedom from tyranny has not come. And while the kind of tortures that they were used to might not be prevalent all throughout the world, there are places in the world where people are still brutally tortured en masse for disagreeing. So that might not be a very satisfying answer because it doesn't point and say, oh, it was wrong. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was bad.
No, I understand. But, I understand. Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Further thoughts, things that jump out at you?
Well, in chapter 9, they're talking about giving people white robes. I'm assuming those people are the ones that have repented and they're going to be saved, because then in chapter 12, the whole world is going down, down, down. So I'm thinking that in chapter 9, people in white robes are going to be people that are saved, and the people in chapter 12 be the ones that were sinners and were not going to be saved. Am I reading that right?
Well, you know, let's keep chapters 9 and 12 for the days when we're all reading chapters 9 and 12. So I'm going to keep that.
No, I don't mean
on the back burner.
I mean verses 9 and 12.
Okay. So what they think the white robes are, they were given specifically to the martyrs. Not everyone who's going to be saved, just the people who have in the past and more recently have been killed because of their hope and faith in the Lord God Almighty. And then in 12, this is a tricky bit, because what we see is something akin to genocide. We see wide-scale violence and murder happen, and it seems to be happening at God's bequest. Now, God himself did not say, do it, but everyone in God's court, in the worshiping throne room, was cheering them on. One of the four creatures who were worshiping God, who we now associate with the four gospels, were saying to one to each of the four horsemen, come. We can look at this two ways, probably more than two ways. We can see this as God's going to kill everyone who disagrees with him. That in the end of time, God's just going to have a massacre. God's going to kill everybody who doesn't agree. That is one way to look at this. It's brutal, but so is the book. A different way to look at this is John is being given a vision by God, and John's language of hope is really violent. And it's not God who says, I will kill people. But John is looking at his world and seeing good people die all the time. And saying, well, God must approve of it. It must be okay. It must be part of God's plan. Because if I can't believe that the horrible world I live in isn't part of God's plan, then there is no hope for me in the world. There's no hope at all. And so part of John's life is violent. And the way he hopes is violent. And the imagery he uses is violent. His world is violence. And so the only way that God can speak to him is in the language that he knows, which is violence. And if we take this view or one like it, what we need to do then is translate the message that God is trying to give to John out of John's language of violence and into our language, which is, let us be honest, not totally nonviolent. Not if we're really being honest about it. It is less violent. And so if we translate this message, what do we get? Well, we get a message of hope. We get a message of reconciliation. We get a message that says, in effect, the pain you feel is not the end. The fear you feel will dissipate. The hope you have to live in peace will one day come to fruition. And all the people who have hurt you will no longer hurt you. That would be a less violent version of the message. Now, it doesn't sound remotely like what John had, because John's language is pretty violent. And by pretty violent, you just read it. You know that's an understatement.
Does he get, in later chapters, does he get to a more humane?
No.
Okay.
No, his language remains violent. Okay. He gets to places where it's not all about violence anymore. But that doesn't mean that he has suddenly become softer and gentler.
Okay.
And one of the things that I truly do love about the Revelation to John, and I got to be honest, there's not much that I love about the Revelation to John, but one of the things that I do love about it is that it puts Jesus's ministry of love in sharp contrast, because it wasn't like the way of love that Jesus was preaching and teaching and doing all of these things for. We might see that as somewhat normal because we've been reading about it all our lives. You know, if we're cradle Christians, we've heard about this our whole lives. Mm-hmm. But when he was walking and talking and breathing in the world, it was violent imagery. It was violence everywhere. The world was not the world of Jesus that we imagine. The world was the world of John. That was reality. Mm-hmm. A pause. Donna, do you have sound now?
No.
Yes, you do.
Wonderful, Donna.
Okay.
Great.
You just great. Muted yourself, Donna. You had sound, and then you clicked the microphone button, and it muted you. Click the microphone again.
Do I have sound now?
Yes. Hallelujah. Okay. Oh, hallelujah.
Okay.
All right.
You're saying that Jesus's world was violent, and we know that, I mean, the Romans could easily have massacred the Jews. You know, they had that power. And so, you know, boy, that's violent. Sure.
It is. It is. So, Donna.
Yes.
You've been silent for the last 15 minutes. Do you have any thoughts to share with us on either chapter?
You know, as I listened to you talk about the violence and the people of Israel, one after another of onslaught and domination and terror and all that good stuff, I'm sitting here thinking, and these are God's chosen people. That's what's striking me, and I think, oh, wow, maybe we shouldn't be chosen people. I don't know. That's a very strange thing, I think.
Yeah. If that's how they're being treated, oh, my God, you know, what about us Gentiles?
We're not chosen. So what?
One of the ways, and believe me, the Jewish people have noticed this as well, Donna.
Yes.
And they noticed it a while ago. And one of the things that they really wrestled with is, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yes.
And why are we here?
Right.
And so one of the ways that they have wrestled with and not really solved the problem, but it kind of the ongoing working solution to the issue, is to think, God made us a deal. We have to follow his rules, and his rules are humane and holy and good, and they require us to be genuinely kind to one another and not to take advantage and not to be corrupt, mm-hmm. and not to hold things over. And we haven't done that. We broke the rules first. And so this is God's punishment to wake us up so that we can follow God's law. And if you read the prophets, this is all through the prophets. All the prophets are reacting to unjust rulers,
right,
who have become corrupt, and the mm-hmm. whole system has become corrupt. And if we had just followed God's rules from the beginning, God would not have forsaken us. But one of the fascinating things about 2 Maccabees, when the Maccabees are, it's a group of brothers, are being tortured. Well, a group of brothers and their mother, who also had to witness their torture. Antiochus IV Epiphanes was not a nice person. So one of the things that comes out in 2 Maccabees is this really moving statement of faith and understanding. And the way they understood it was, you know, we are in this situation because we as a people have sinned, but God's anger will not burn against us for long, and he will redeem us and you. And then, you know, he stuck his hands out and his tongue out so they could be chopped off and fried before him, before he was scalped and then fried himself. It's brutal.
It is brutal.
And gruesome.
I know.
And interestingly enough, where we get the word macabre from, and where the concept of a dance macabre.
Maccabees.
The dance of the Maccabees.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah, it is horrible.
Wow.
Well, that some of the other questions, you know, about the horses and all that were on my mind, but you addressed all of those as we went along. So,
okay.
It just seems like that one, that third opening of the seal, just seems sort of out of place to me. Everything else is apocalyptic and awful, you know. The horses and all these terrible things are happening, and the third seal with the you know, all of a sudden we're into wheat, a measure of wheat.
Uh-huh.
There's the scales. I get
we
that.
Have, it's the interlude of the corrupt merchant. That's what I call it.
The corrupt.
And he gets a speaking role. And if you think of it, it's very timely, because corruption is everywhere. And I don't think necessarily now, you know, if I think about the idea that one of the main fears we've had in terms of the end of the world is war and conquering people, you know, just killing people, because, you know, North Korea has been shooting off missiles lately, and that's disturbing. When I think of the scales, I no longer think of the famine that takes over the world after, you know, during war, after war, though that is certainly an issue. The thing that I think of now is how I would think of it as the radical injustice of food companies that create food that's not really food anymore. And they market it to low-income people, and they price it so low-income people can afford it more readily than more nutritious food that is more expensive. And I see that as a profound injustice, because it's affecting everyone who eats it. You know, you have fewer, you have less nutrition in your life. It's a subtle experience that changes your health. It changes your capacity to think clearly. It may have causes later in life, and not just, you know, when you hit your 60s and 70s, but later in life when you hit your 30s and 40s, for being less healthy than you might otherwise be. And it's all to turn a profit. And the essence of the speaking role that the third horseman of the apocalypse has is that people are dying to turn a profit. And so I think about people dying to turn a profit. Literally, people dying to turn a profit, and then people dying because others are turning a profit.
A bigger question is it the nature of man to be corrupt?
Excellent. Excellent question, Donna. Is it the nature of man to be corrupt? What
is
do
it,
you
is
guys
that our think? Natural bent is to tend to be corrupt as
what do you guys think? Grace, Jeanette, where are you at with this question?
Well, I think that man has the capability to be either good or bad, and that each person may be inclined in different directions due to their personality and the way they were raised or their hereditary, their genes or whatever. But I think some people are have sort of a nature to be corrupt, and other people have the nature to be very good and kind and loving. And, you know, I've seen both types of people, you know, I think we all have. So, and some people lean one way and the other people lean the other way.
Grace, where are you at on this question? Is it man's nature to be corrupt?
Well, yes, but most of the people I know are good people. But I know there are a lot of bad people out in the world. Look what's going on in the world. Look how bad people are. So we know there's corruption going on all over the place. But you have to ask God to bring love and goodness back into this country and the world.
That's for sure.
Here's my answer. It's different from all of yours. I think that it is our nature to be like God. And that it seems easier for most people, or many people, to be corrupt instead. And that the voice for God that speaks to us and says, you know, there's another way to do this, is in many people very small and very quiet, almost non-existent. But I think that it can't truly be non-existent, because I think it is God's voice in us that is actually, well, okay, this is a generational thing, but this is how I think of it. It's in our machine code. It is in the basic instructions for us to be us. I do not think that corruption is in the basic instructions, but I do think it came along second.
Right.
And it's very compelling.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Donna, what's your thought?
Well, it just seems like so many of our leaders and people who are in power become corrupt. And you know, it really bothers me to see what we call leaders taking bribes, being bought by PACs, you know, that type of thing. And it bothers me because it's, you know, these are the folks that are supposed to be leading us into something better, and spending our money in ways that will benefit people and all that kind of stuff. And so often millions, billions of dollars are thrown at projects that just they don't go anywhere. They don't do anything. The money never does get to the people who are eating the crappy food. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I'm getting a bit jaded about it, because after 80 some years of waiting for something to change, but then say I'm not a Jew. Now they waited thousands of years. So, you know, I can't.
Maybe
I'm impatient, I think. So I guess that's what prompted the idea of, you know, I really do believe that I believe, for instance, being a Christian, that I am not corrupt. There are corrupt Christians, but I, you know, my belief of the dignity of every person, and that person should have what we all benefit from, and you know, and we're all worthwhile in our own way, and I just so it's hard. It's kind of hard to put in words what. It just seems so incongruous what's going on in our world, in our country especially.
I like very much what you said, Sarah, that we were created in the image of God, and we've got to remember that we've got within our, being, our core, we have that. So
I guess.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree, because what I learned as a child being raised in a Christian household was to be kind, to be loving, to give to others, to be concerned about people who have less than you, all of those good things.
Right.
To be honest. And at different times in my life, just little minor things where I was in positions of some relatively small amount of power, people would come and, gee, if you buy this product for the hospital, because I was on the committee that did that, we're going to give everybody a bike. That's small corruption. Okay.
Right.
And I said, no, we're not giving everybody a bike. This isn't going to happen, kind of thing. Or the salesman, when I was director of a nursing program, who wanted me to buy uniforms from him, well, he would take me to lunch and I would insist on buying my own lunch. I'll send you some shoes. No, please don't do that, kind of thing. And they,
right,
they're small things, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. all of a sudden the small things turn into big things.
Yes.
Right.
And it's easy to accept. Harm done.
They became greedier and greedier. Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a real, I think it's a very discreet and slippery slope that we spend mm-hmm. our lives on,
yes.
trying mm-hmm. to be honest. And, most of the time we hopefully would be honest, but it's real easy to slip into dishonesty. That's mm-hmm. why I think it's a, I don't know. I guess that's what prompted the question.
So. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a little sarcasm too. if you're the chosen people, holy cow,
yes.
get off that list,
uh-huh. Absolutely. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. Yes. Thank you so much for joining me today. It will be recorded, and you can find it on the podcast and let other people who weren't here know that they can listen to it later. Liz will put that up on the website and in the podcast site this week. I don't know her time scale, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And next week, we will be looking at chapters 7 and 8.
Okay, good. Okay. Looking forward to it. Definitely.
I'll see you next week.
Yes, thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
See you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.